most of my service was in the CID. I served in the Serious Crime Squad, the Scottish Crime Squad. I was DCI in the Drug Squad. I was head of Force Intelligence Bureau. Then I worked as a homicide murder investigator. I was senior investigating officer. I was head of CID in Lanarkshire, head of CID in the East End of Glasgow. And before I went into the Violence Reduction Unit, I was deputy head of the CID for Strathclyde. And then 2005, along with Karen McCluskey, a colleague, we established the Violence Reduction Unit in Glasgow for Strathclyde region at that time. And then I think it was about a year or 15 months later, it became the Scottish Violence Reduction Unit. And I worked there and headed that up along with Karen until 2013. I retired just before Police Scotland came into being. And then I worked for a time at St Andrews University, just really trying to corral the academics onto the one page. It's the one thing in my career that I failed miserably at, but anyway, there you go. and then I retired probably from there, I think, 2014, the end of 2014. And since then, I just do bits and pieces just to keep my hand in. And so I'm currently probably just an enthusiastic amateur.
And John, we're going to kind of focus on the kind of themes around your recent book called Conviction, and perfectly focusing on the work of the Scotland's Violence Reduction Unit. And just to start off with, then, can you just, for maybe our international listeners, and just to kind of recap for those of us based in Scotland, can you just remind us about the scale of the problem in Scotland with regards to violence?
Yeah, we're probably where London are right now. We were at that stage where we began to think it was normal. We just dealt with things as normal. And it was only when we took a breath and started to compare ourselves with international statistics to get an idea of exactly where we were, we realised how bad it was. For instance, we had 3.5 times the number of murders committed by a knife than anywhere else in Europe. And our murder rate for our most at-risk group was 5.3 per 100,000 of our population. And at that time in 2014 in England and Wales, that same group, it was 1 per 100,000 of our population. So whilst there were certainly places that were, when you look at that population level, it gives you those figures. If you drill down to that, you can find places, for instance, in Lewis, there's not many murders in Lewis. There's lots of murders in Glasgow. There's not many murders in perhaps Kendal, but there's lots in London. So, but the population level gave us that idea and made us realise that, this was really big. There's no reason we should be experiencing this. We had to understand better how we were. I mean, and that translated, I think, into big numbers for homicide as well. I think in 2004, 2005, we had 142 murders in Scotland. We had 828 attempt murders, which is huge. And if you think in relation to the attempt murders, for instance, we know that that's crime figures. The real numbers are probably double that and could be as much as three times that, because we knew from some work that had been done by Health in Cardiff, by Professor Jonathan Shepherd, injury surveillance, and they understood that only between a half and a third of people who turned up at A&Es as a result of violence actually reported it to the police. So when we speak about crime figures, the crime figures are largely irrelevant, and that was one of the big things for us to say, look, we need to flush these numbers out and understand it. So internationally, Scotland was, it had that, Glasgow had the murder capital of Europe. It was violent. But there will be people in Scotland who live in, the East Nuka Fife who don't recognise that. But the truth of the matter is, at that population level, that it was well described as that. It was an accurate description.
And so can you just tell us about how the Violence Reduction Unit came about? I mean, from my reading and Conviction, it was kind of off its moment, and there was lots of support and a kind of willingness to try out something different that maybe didn't focus solely on the criminal justice system.
Yeah, I think it was exactly that. That's what we found. I mean, the catalyst for us, there was, you know, that within Strathclyde Police, there were a couple of things came together. First of all, Karen McCluskey arrived at Strathclyde Police. She is a forensic psychologist. She was head of our, she was principal analyst, intelligence analyst, and she was charged with creating an analytical structure within Strathclyde Police, which was a huge job, and what she did. So she arrived, and when she arrived, she started looking far more clinically at the figures that I had been working with at this time for 29, 30 years and never thought, just thought that's the way they were. Sir Willie Ray was the chief constable, a really thoughtful, empowering chief, a great leader. And I was deputy head of CID. Karen and I started talking about the levels of violence. We thought we should do something else about it. And this was just over coffee and in between jobs because our offices were in the same corridor. And Karen prepared a report that was submitted to the chief constable. He saw us both and said, right, okay, what do you think we should do? And we said, well, we don't know. But a good start would be lock four smart people in a room and don't let them out until they've got an answer. And he said, okay, find a room and another two people and get on with it. And that was it. And that's literally how it started. And there was no, you know, here's our strategy, here's our plan. The simple strategy was to reduce violence. That was it. So there was no idea that you need to do this within 3 months, 6 months, 2 years, 5 years. We need to see a reduction of X percent here or X percent there. What are the KPI? We didn't start off with that at all. He just said, go away and examine that problem. Have a look at that problem in forensic detail and let's understand better what's happening. And once we've done that, there was a confidence that once we understood it better, we could then start to see how it happened. And when we did that, and we went to speak to other people in social work, in education, in health. I mean, we met Harry Burns when he was director, or Sir Harry Burns when he was director of public health in Glasgow. John Butcher was head of secondary schools in Glasgow. You know, Anne-Marie Rafferty, Mike Burns were in social work in Glasgow. We went to speak to these people, and they were at the same crossroads. They were working with the same people and were frustrated by the sameness of it. And there was a danger that everyone was being overwhelmed by, you know, their everyday work. And when we started to discuss it, we realized that these people that we were defining by the service we deliver to them, whether they be pupils or they be witnesses or they be patients or they be clients, they were the same people. And we realized if we started to work together, we could perhaps, you know, find a shared agenda and say, well, look, let's just prioritize these people on this one thing. And so the one thing was violence reduction, because nobody's going to say to you, I don't want to make the world less violent. Nobody's going to say that to you. And if someone did, you would run away very quickly. But, you know, so we found that, look, let's do something about violence. So that's really how it started.
John, what really stood out for me in the book, sorry to interrupt, was just following on from what you're saying there about speaking about, you know, whether the pupil is a client somewhere else and is a victim. You argue in the book that really there was very little way to differentiate between someone being more likely or less likely to be a victim or a perpetrator, i.e. it was almost just fate or a quirk of fate or luck that led to somebody being a victim rather than a perpetrator. Can you just maybe elaborate on that and how that links in with the kind of gang culture that's existed in Glasgow?
Yeah, sure. I mean, when we started to look at this in more detail, we might have been about 18 months or so, or maybe a year into it, when we realised and discovered that this was really a public health issue. And so we started to think about it in those terms. And in doing that, we first of all uncovered the idea of adverse childhood experiences, work that had been done by Faliti and Anda in the States, and that had been brought over by the World Health Organization saying, look, these have an impact on a life course, adverse childhood experiences. And when I started looking at that then, having been head of CID in London Road in the East and in Lanarkshire, and having been a detective sergeant in Easterhouse, realised as I was reading about adverse childhood experiences that the people that I was locking up for a murder were the same sort of people who were that I was speaking to, the same family as almost as the victim. You know, it was the same look in their face, the same background. They lived in the same street. They didn't live far away. They had poor educational outcomes. They had poor aspirations, lack of positive male role models. All the things were constant. And that's one of the reasons we called it the Violence Reduction Unit. Because when we looked at just homicides, if we looked at just murders, which is what everyone looks at, because that's the one the media latches onto often, we find that lots of our murders were a single stab wound to the upper torso. You know, they hit a major structure. And it was a happenstance. I mean, the violence was deliberate. But when you met these young men, they would say, I didn't mean to kill him. And the truth of the matter is, they didn't. They, you know, that's not what they intended to do. They carried a knife because everybody else they knew carried a knife. They fought in a gang because everybody else they knew fought in a gang. They stabbed him because, well, that's what you do, and I've been stabbed and I haven't died, and I know another four or five people who have been stabbed and they haven't died. And so it was just that idea of that's what we do. You know, these young men seem to be stuck in the same rut that the police were stuck in, you know, doing the same thing all the time, thinking, you know, you're going to get a different outcome, you know, lock more people up and do more of that. These young guys were in the same sort of rut, that same vicious cycle. And we just thought, well, look, maybe if we gave them a different opportunity, something might come out of this. And that's how we got onto the gangs thing. That's how we moved on to serve. Because we had, at the start, what we tried to do to make the change is we had control over what the police did, so we could do something about that. So first of all, in 2005, for instance, we started to process MAP. It was a really sexy bit of work. Process MAP, everyone who was arrested carrying a knife or caught carrying a knife, to find out what happened to them. Now, in those days, 2005, high visibility policing for public reassurance was the ethos, that everyone thought that's what we needed. And so if a young man was caught carrying a knife and we knew who he was and we didn't think he was going to commit another offence that night and he wasn't wanted in Warren, then we would just caution and charge him at the locus at the scene and allow him to go. And we'd report the case to the procurator fiscal. And what we found was the average length of time between being caught with a knife and appearing at court was 14 months. 14 months. Now, you know that expression about justice delayed is justice denied? It needs to be. So we said, look, if we want to take knife crime seriously and knife violence seriously, we must address this. So we changed, we got the Lord Advocate to change the guidelines. So if someone was caught in the street with a knife, they were arrested, taken to a police office, fingerprinted, photographed and DNA'd. They were kept in custody until they appeared at court. We would oppose bail. And when we opposed bail, we would put in an enhanced bail report about saying, here's the level of violence in the street or the area where this young man lives. We would, if they were given bail, we would ask for restrictions on it. And the procurator fiscals were on board. They fast-tracked all of these cases. And all of a sudden we had, I mean, the prison service weren't very keen because all of a sudden we had lots of young men in remand. But it was that case of, you know, the health analogy is we had to stabilize the patient. And sometimes that takes heroic work. You know, it sometimes takes things like that, quite dramatic. We had the maximum sentence for carrying a knife increase from 2 years to 4 years. So when you hear people say that the public health approach is the soft approach and that it wasn't in any way an abdication of criminal justice responsibility, it was an acceptance that saying we've done all of this and still our knife crime and our violence is too high. So we must do something else. And that's when we started then to be able to persuade people to come on board much, much easier. And we could demonstrate to Scottish Government, we could demonstrate much easier with evidence that criminal justice doesn't work alone.
So, obviously, most of our listeners being practicing the teachers, John, can you tell us how much the kind of education side of things was important in starting to change the culture in Glasgow and Scotland?
I think it was absolutely huge. I mean, if you think about it, one of the things that we introduced quite early on was campus police officers, and because the young men who are at risk, the only time they ever bump into a police officer is in a confrontational situation. So when we spoke to head teachers, we found that the same young men, as I said earlier, the same young men were the ones who were causing name problems in schools. So we introduced the idea of campus police officers. And what happened, first of all, is that, you know, head teachers were saying, well, we don't want police officers. This, you're saying I can't look after my school? We don't, you know, there was real, you know, there was a real pushback on it. But we got campus police officers into a couple of schools where head teachers saw it and were a bit more open to that idea. And within about a year or 2 years, we had these head teachers speaking to other head teachers. And all of a sudden, everybody wanted a campus police officer because they weren't there to supplant teachers' authority. They weren't there to deal with discipline in classrooms, but they were there to deal with the drama before it became a crisis. So they used to work closely with head teachers and people support and all the right and psychologists in the school, all the right people. And for instance, if a campus officer went into school on a Monday morning and found that John Carleton wasn't in that day, he wasn't there, but his exam was on Tuesday afternoon, he was sitting in whatever it was. And then we found, the campus police officer found that, lo and behold, his dad was locked up for serious assault on Saturday night. For domestic abuse, for assaulting his mother on Saturday night. So perhaps that's the reason for it. So they used to make joint visits. Campus officers would make joint visits. They would be in the playground when primary sevens became year ones at secondary school, first year at secondary school. They were the friendly face. And that started to build that connection between police and schools. And at the same time, Cam and I were speaking to directors of education and head teachers. And I mean, teachers already know this. Teachers have a huge influence on young people's lives. Now, not every young pupil is going to tell you there and then, you know, the impact you have. But for many young kids, school is the consistent place where they meet consistent adults who care for them and look after them and have their best interests at heart. And they're there for them all the time. So there was that. I mean, it was very, very easy to see the connection that we're in. But it was also difficult because teachers wanted to do their job, and every teacher I've met wants to do their job as best they can for everyone. And if you've got 75 pupils in a classroom and four of them are causing bloody havoc, and you can't do much about, you can't help the other, you know, 31 because of these four, the easy thing is to get them out of class. And I understand that. But get them out of that class, but don't get them out of school. Because once you start to exclude them from education and they're on the streets and they're expelled, no good comes of it. No good comes of it whatsoever. The idea that kids learn from that, you know, kids who don't want to be in school, and as a punishment, what we do is we expel them. Really? I mean, it's exactly what they wanted. So what John Butcher did is he started to say, right, okay, these kids can't be in that classroom because they're too disruptive at the moment, but you're not getting away with this. You will be educated, even if you don't care about yourselves. We do. So Glasgow started to find a way of dealing with these pupils so that they had them together and gave them far more intensive support. And that made a huge difference to things. And it also changed the attitudes. It also changed their thinking about that shared agenda, about understanding that we're all doing the same thing. And, you know, and if these young guys are better behaved, attainment's going to be better, learning's going to be better, teaching's going to be much, much better, and teachers can do what they're really good at, which are the deliver the technical skills that they've got in that environment and educate young people in front of them. And after all, schools are a venue for education. That's what they're there for. It's not just a place where pupils go. It's a venue for education. And it's that, you know, that example, it's the very heart of it. And now there's much more understanding about, you know, with adverse childhood experiences. Teachers always knew. Primary teachers knew kids coming in from nursery and, you know, the challenges they were going to have because of families. And so the understanding now of family-centred learning, the inclusion far more of families and other people in a child's life and their education is becoming much, much better. I mean, it used to be, for instance, you would think, and there may be still some teachers who think like this, that teaching is a profession, therefore the professional knows best, and that's true. But over the years, I've noticed sometimes things that are expected of teachers and schools, you can't possibly do. Now, there's no way in the world, for instance, you can raise attainment on your own. I don't think teachers or schools can raise attainment on their own. What you can do is, you can be that venue, you can be that place that says, right, look, everyone, this is our share of the agenda. Our share of the agenda is helping these pupils be as good as they can be and get out of life what they can get. What they can get. It's to give them that thirst for learning and knowledge to be as good as they can be. But you're not just going to do that on your own. You need the family involved in that. You need the community involved in that. And if you need at times police or social services or psychological services, whoever you need involved in that. Because before, like the police, I think education takes on responsibilities for things that they can't deliver. And when it's something comes out or there's some report on the TV, and I would say, you know, stand up and say, no, we can't do this on our own. There's things that teachers are terrific at on their own, in a classroom with everyone there ready to learn and teachers delivering and doing their thing. Superb. That's why Scotland, you know, had probably one of the best educational systems in the world. But it's times are changing. Families are different. Communities are different. Attitudes are different. It's really difficult. And I don't think teachers can do lots of that stuff on their own. So I think it's about sharing that out. You know, the Christie Commission spoke about that. You know, that working much better towards single goals. And the education of young people, that has to be everyone's goal. The same as violence reduction was everyone's goal at that time. I think the education of young people has to be everyone's goal as well. And then we understand better how they might do that.
That's a really powerful message, John. And so the whole idea of the shared agenda to prevent violence and to reduce violence. And you did mention briefly earlier on there, and I would imagine, having grown up in Scotland and been in Scotland all my days, that domestic violence is also a major factor, both for the direct victim of domestic violence, but also these young people that were trying to give a really good education to and a good start in life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we don't fix domestic violence, we'll never fix violence. I mean, violence fundamentally is about inequality. That's the most unequal countries in the world are the most violent. And I remember once listening to and then having dinner with a professor from Ottawa called Richard Tremblay. And he was speaking about epigenetics, and he was speaking about his speciality is violent and violent children. And I had asked him the question, I said, why is it some young people learn to be violent? And how do they learn to be violent? And he said, well, you perhaps need to think about that the other way around. He said, we learn not how to be violent, we learn how not to be violent. So we learn how to communicate, to negotiate, we learn how to compromise, we learn about relationships and empathy and compassion and care, we learn about all of those things. And we learn those in the early years. Those are non-cognitive skills. And so if you think when we then deal with, if we then come up against adversity or challenges in our life as we go through our life, if we have learned all of these other human attributes and skills, then we have a whole array of responses to particular challenges. But if we've never learned any of those, then all we have is violence and aggression. And domestic violence in particular. If you're to be clear at the outset, not every young boy who witnesses his mother being assaulted by his father or the other way around will turn out to be a domestic abuser. There's no evidence that supports that at all. However, there's lots of evidence that support the idea that witnessing that aggression and violence on a regular basis has a chronic effect and negative effect on how you develop. And so if you imagine, you know, a young boy or a young girl coming into a classroom where the teacher's ready to go and everyone's ready to go, but that young kid spent the weekend looking after their mum because their father had been drunk and had been battering their mother and they had been trying to protect them. And now they were at school thinking about what happened and worrying about what it was going to be like when they went home that night. How is a teacher going to engage? Now, I don't care how good the teacher is, and we've got some fabulous teachers. I don't care how interesting the subject is, you're not going to engage that kid because they're not thinking about anything else except how to get through the day. And if you add on that in terms of adverse childhood experiences, if you then add in poverty, if you then add in, do we have enough food at home? Is it going to be warm at home? Is my mum going to be there when I get home tonight? Am I going to have clean clothes to come to school? So when you're talking about you need to work hard so that you can, you know, you can be the best you can be when you leave school, whether you go to university or whether you get a job, whatever you do. Lots of these kids are just trying to get through the day. That's all they're trying to do. And teachers realise that. And so the kids in the classroom that need that most help, it's difficult for a teacher with a class of 35, really difficult. But if the school all together and the family and the community and anyone else who can help can assist with that, that will make it better for everybody. But domestic violence is a key. We've no idea, for instance, the level of violence against women in Scotland. We've none. We've never had a prevalence study. So I think the figure that's often used is one that came, I think, from work down in England, and it was the late 90s, that said a woman will be the victim of domestic violence 34 times before she reports it to the police. So if you think about that, if every one that we have, you think, well, okay, that keeps 34 times, how many do we have? It's really, really prevalent. It's everywhere. And I think it crosses class. It's not something like interpersonal violence between young men, which almost clusters like a disease in poorer areas. I think domestic violence will go across. But I don't know that for certain because we've never had a prevalence study. But I think it's a huge issue, huge issue.
John, I'm conscious of time and I'm jumping ahead here. I'm sure listeners will be really interested to hear, you know, what, just maybe before you go into it, you know, just recapping what the Violence Reduction Unit wanted to achieve. I suppose that maybe changed over time to an extent, but more importantly, what successes, you know, kind of evidenced successes did the unit achieve?
Right, well, I mean, there was lots of things because while we didn't have that KPI when we started, you know, but we did with individual initiatives that we took on. For instance, when we wanted to reduce that 14 months between arrest and prison, we did that very successfully and very quickly. The gang stuff in the East End of Glasgow, we reduced violent offending by 46%. Weapon carrying was reduced by 85%. Knife carrying in particular was reduced by 58%. And gang fights reduced by 73%. Easterhouse Police Office is now a part-time police office. It closes at 5 o'clock at night. And whilst in Scotland, overall, there was a reduction in violence between 2005 and 2014, there was a reduction, I think it was 57%. And it's true that there was a reduction elsewhere as well, but the reduction in England and Wales was 52%. So there was 25% of a distance, which was, that's statistically significant for us. In relation to murders, in 2013-14, we had 61 murders. Remember, in 2010, 10 years earlier, we had 142. The attempt murders, we had 830 odd. In 2005 and 2014, we had 317. So, you know, there were significant things. But I think the most important thing is the idea now of collaboration and shared agendas, the idea that we think about things in a different way than we do in England and Wales and elsewhere. I mean, if you look even in our media, when we have murders, and we still have far too many murders, there's no clamour for we need to build more prisons and we need to bring back a death penalty and they're not getting enough in prison. There's not the same clamour here. There seems to be far more of an understanding about prevention and being committed to prevention. We've a bit to go, I think. But that commitment to prevention means we're now thinking about adverse childhood experiences and making education in schools and police trauma aware. I mean, Police Scotland are now talking about and doing, in one division, Ayrshire Division, led by Paul Main, the divisional commander, they're making that division trauma aware. So they're going to make every police officer give them an understanding of adverse childhood experiences so that when they're dealing with young people, they have a better understanding of why that young person is acting like that. The same way as teachers get an understanding. So we ask the question, rather than why are you behaving like that, the question we ask is, what happened to you? Because if you think, We had the children's reporters, the children's hearing system, which speaks about dealing with a deed, not dealing with a deed, dealing with a need, which was revolutionary back in 1967, 68. But I think we've lost our way a bit with that. I'd like to see, for instance, I'd like to see non-age being raised to 15. I'd like to see us having a proper a justice system for young people who need help. I'd like to see the school starting age, for instance, rise to 7 and have formal kindergarten. I'd like to see parental leave been 2 years. Because if we value, I mean, we keep talking about we want Scotland to be the best place to grow up because we value our children. Well, if we value our children, we need to value their parents, and particularly their mums. Because right now, it seems to me that the childcare that we're offering is about getting mums back to work. It's not about children. It's about getting mums back to work. There's a few exceptions to that where real quality childcare is there. But we need to understand those early years are hugely important. And we need to invest as much in the early years staff, teaching, methodology. We need to invest as much in that as we do in tertiary education. We absolutely must do that. And the non-age, the raising the age would be hugely important. We keep speaking about the Nordic arc, you know, and we look at OECD figures and we say, look at Finland, how fabulous it's there, and Sweden. And Finnish kids don't go to school until they're 7. They don't get examined until they get to, you know, 15. What are we doing? So we're getting caught up in that same measurement stuff, and this is the measure, and we need to know, we need this baseline. Now, as I said, I'm not a teacher, but it seems to me that not every kid will learn in the same way. They'll not learn at the same pace. They don't all come at the same time. They don't all come from the same background. They don't all have the same issues in their lives. They're like grown-ups. They have the same. We're all different. We all go different places in the life. But it seems to me sometimes we expect a uniformity. You know, when kids walk into primary one, we expect a uniformity there. And I know in primary schools they try and do it differently, but it's really difficult. And I think it needs far more support in that early years, far more support and investment.
Just finally, John, being very topical at the moment, I'm just wondering if you maybe give us an idea of how you and colleagues have maybe been brought in or drawn into the debates with regards to the situation around violence in London at present, and what your own opinions are there, and how they might learn from the work of you and your colleagues.
I've been inundated. In fact, I'm actually doing the Jeremy Vine show at 12:30 today for the sake of the same thing. You know, we've all been down at London at different times. I was down 3 or 4 weeks ago, met with Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott and Sadiq Khan. The commissioner we met has been up in Scotland, and we met with the commissioner and the deputy mayor who was responsible for crime and justice down there. And I think they're just startled at it right now by the scale of it. And I think they need to break it down into like a borough level. I think 52 boroughs. They need to break it down into a borough level and say, let's start working here, because that's where the answer is. The answer's not in a top-down pull the lever and it'll be fixed thing. The answer is in the ground up. And there's lots of great work going on in London. And I know they have lots of violence right now, but I shudder to think where that violence would be without the great work that's ongoing. And so they just need to think about that and perhaps invest in that a bit more. But it's always difficult because I'm always loath to say this is what you should do. Because I don't live in London. It's really difficult down there. But I know that when we brought the gangs project over, we brought it from Cincinnati, where it was designed to deal with black African-American men. And we used it here unchanged. All we changed was the language. You know, we didn't use that American language or that American accent, obviously. We used Scots language, and it was in the context here. And it worked. So I think that if we did the same, or they did the same sort of thing in London, but it was London people who were doing it, and it was young black men who were doing it there, and from other ethnic groups who were doing it there, it would work. It needs that local context, and that starts at the ground up. But the media always ask, you know, what's the mayor doing about it? What's the Home Secretary doing about it? What's the Chief of Police doing about it? And the truth of the matter is, you know, sometimes these leaders, have to just get out of the way and support communities doing something about it, because that's where the change starts. That's where the change starts. I'm sure if you ask your, you know, teachers, it's great. I mean, John Swinney, I think, I'm a huge fan of John Swinney. He's a real big thinker, and, you know, he's got the way ahead. But I'm sure at times that great hierarchical pyramid, I'm sure teachers would say, look, let's just do this here. Let's just get on and do our job here. Let's do it. Let's understand the direction of travel and let's go with it. Everyone wants to have our schools the best in the world. There's no doubt about that. Everybody wants to do the best they can. The same as no parent wants to be a bad parent and make their kids' life a misery. Everyone tries the best they can. And I remember a great expression I heard once from a teacher who said, you know, parents don't just send us their bad kids. They send all their kids, you know. You know, they send us who they've got, and that's important. And I think the quote for me that makes the most sense in relation to education and teachers was by James Heckman, who's a Nobel laureate in economics. He was the Allender Institute in 2003 or 2004. Tom Hunter brought him over. And he said, a major determinant of successful schools is successful families. And that's the key. So teachers can only work with what parents provide. So, you know, I mean, I've got a friend who's a principal teacher in East Rain, and he said, yeah, we've got the highest results. I said, you've got the highest results because the parents there are different and they live different lives. That's how you get the highest results. Not because you're better teachers, you know. I said, you'll be good teachers and you'll be able to fulfill your potential because of the support you're getting from families. I said, but if you've got two or three kids in your classroom whose families had poor educational experiences and outcomes and are living in difficult situations, it's hard for them to support their kids. Therefore, it's hard for the teacher and it's hard for the kid. So it's that understanding, you know, we need to all work together. It's a team game. And bring what we can to bear. Start where you are, do what you can with what you've got. That's what makes the difference.
John, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and your very valued opinions this morning. Greatly appreciated on behalf of the EduTalk listeners.